Children are dismissed to Cool Club. So I've been subbing for my wife. She's a teacher, and she's on maternity leave right now. And in fact, the new addition is here in the building. Little Holland is here, and we're excited. So you'll get to see her later today. So being back in the classroom and teaching, it's kind of bringing me back to the days when I was a student, back when I went to school, what that was like. I'm recalling what I felt back then, and there was something that I was a good student. I enjoyed school for the most part. I enjoyed going to tests and being able to succeed. I didn't enjoy the test, but I enjoyed the success that would come when I knew the answers, when I had studied and actually got answers right. I enjoyed that. But there was something I really hated about those tests. There'd be times where I studied my tail off and I knew the material. I had gone to class and I'd paid attention and I knew this thing inside and out. And so when I go into the test, I'm confident, I'm feeling good. And I open up the test and they're asking me every single question that I don't know the answer to. Like the most obscure thing in the test. I could recite the chapter to you and tell you all about it, but they're asking me this one question about something that I didn't study. I hated that. I hated being prepared and knowing all of this, but the one thing that I needed to know, according to the teacher, that was the one thing that I didn't know. I hated that. I hated when that happened. There are many things in life that are more infuriating than investing in a wide range of things, being prepared, being ready to go. And then when you get there, come to find out there's one thing that you need that you don't have. Isn't that frustrating? Think about going to the DMV and you need to do something and you've got like 7 forms of identification and you wade through that long line and you get to the front and then they finally say to you that they need to see like something obscure, like proof that you have an electric account at your house or something like that. That's the one thing you didn't bring. How frustrating is that? Or if you pack your bags meticulously. You're going on a trip and your luggage is neat and organized. And then you get there to the airport and they ask you for your passport. And you realize, I didn't bring my passport. That's infuriating, isn't it? Is it not? That's so frustrating. I actually know what that feels like. Story time here. It's a little different than that. It's a little different. So we went on a mission trip when I was in high school to Latvia. And so we did all this preparation for this trip. We're going to go do youth camps with the youth there in Latvia. It's going to be a great time, having an awesome time, serving the Lord, doing all that. So we fly the whatever 12, 15, 18 hours, day and a half trying to get to Latvia. We land in London, then we land in Riga. I'm tired, and we get into the airport. And I'm towards the back, and everybody in front of me is going ahead of me, and they're all getting through the line, and there's no problem. Remember, this is 2000, all right? So this was a while ago. I'm getting older. But 2000, in 2000, Latvia was just 9 years out of coming out of the Soviet Union, all right? So it's a different place. Now, if you go to Latvia now, it looks like the rest of Europe. But back then, it looked like you were in Soviet Russia. So the guy behind the booth, he's this Russian bad-looking dude, man. He is a bad-looking dude. He's not looking like he's friendly. He doesn't want to joke. That's the way he's looking. And he's just stamping everybody through. So I get up there, and I hand him my passport. He looks at my passport, looks up, and goes, "Visa." And that's all he says. And I'm like, I don't know what to do. What does that even mean? And so he looks at me again and goes, in his very, very stern Russian-looking way, goes, "Visa." And I'm like, I am halfway across the world, and I don't know how to talk to this guy. He's telling me I need something. I don't know what it is. Turns out he needed to get a visa. Why? Because I was the only Canadian on the trip. Canada had enforced, hey, if you're Latvian, you have to get a visa. So the Latvians were like, well, fine, here, you got to get a visa if you come to our. So I happen to be the one Canadian that goes on this trip. Nobody knew I had to get a visa. So I had to go around the corner and pay some money and get a visa. And it worked out. It was fine. But there was a moment there where I was like, am I going to the gulag? What's going to happen here? I don't know how this is going to go. And I was so frustrated. What are the feelings when you get into a situation like that? Frustration, like, why me? Why didn't anyone tell me I needed a visa? You adults here that are supposed to know stuff, I should know these things, right? It's frustrating. You look for something to blame. You want to figure out what went wrong here because you're infuriated. You may have been extremely diligent in a number of areas, but if you don't have that one thing, you're not getting through. You're not passing. I want you to hold on to that thought because we're going to come back to it. It's going to apply for today's text. So set it aside and we'll come back to it. We've been spending the last 2 weeks and now a third week on the genealogy of Jesus. And I know that sounds about as bland as possible, but actually, I think there's a lot here for us. We're in the beginning of our series on the book of Matthew. And Matthew starts out his book going through the genealogy of Jesus. So, in the first week, we talked about how Matthew declares that Jesus is the King of the Jews. Furthermore, he's the King of the Gentiles and the rest of the world, and he is the King of all creation. That's what we talked about in week one. And then last week, we looked at how right in his genealogy, what we see is that there is a messy history for the Hebrew people. Jesus is coming from a group of people that do not have it all together. They got a whole mess of problems in his descendants and all of their history. And yet, that's whom God chose to come through to save humanity. Amazing. So today we're going to look at one final thing in this genealogy. One final emphasis that Matthew gives us as we look at this genealogy. If you look at the genealogy, you're going to notice that there are five women that are mentioned. Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, Bathsheba, and of course, Mary. And their inclusion is significant. It's not haphazard. Yes, oftentimes genealogies would include women in them. But Matthew's doing something very specific with these four specific women. Mary's obvious. She's the mother. But with those four other women, he's telling you something. He's signaling something about who Jesus is and what he wants us to know. So, with these ladies, we happen to know their stories pretty well. You may not if you're kind of new to church and you haven't been through the Bible a lot, but their stories are pretty prominent, and they come in pretty important places. And it's at this point that it gets puzzling. Why these women? Why would you pick these four women to use to explain why Jesus is so great? Why these ones? Each story carries at least a tinge of scandal, if not an entire heaping horde of scandal in their story. These are not women that you would look at and go, yeah, these are clean cases, and it's obvious why they're in here. It's actually kind of curious why he includes them. So what is he telling us? That's going to be our question that we're going to be looking at today. Why pick these four women, and what is he trying to tell us? So let's begin by refreshing ourselves with their stories. Some of you may know this, but some of you may not. So let's go through their stories. We find Tamar's story in the book of Genesis. Rahab is in the book of Joshua. Ruth is in the book of Ruth, and Bathsheba in 2 Samuel. So we're going to start in order, and let me go through Tamar. We talked a little bit about Tamar last time because she is connected to the story of Judah. So Tamar, she's a Canaanite woman, and she marries Judah's son. Now, Judah's son is wicked and evil, like we talked about last time, and so God kills him. And then Judah gives his second born son to be married to Tamar, and guess what? He's wicked and evil too, so God kills him as well. So here she is, double widowed, And so Judah looks at his youngest son and goes, well, the last, this didn't go well. The last dude died if I gave him to Tamar, so do I really want to do this? So he tells Tamar, hey, just wait till he's old enough, and when he comes of age, I'll give him in marriage to you. He'll take care of you, provide for you, all that. So, boy grows up, he reaches age, Judah doesn't give him to Tamar. Time keeps going, Tamar looks at the situation, I'm a widow, this isn't going well, I am not being provided for, Judah's not going to give me this guy, so I got to take things into my own hands. So, she devises this plan. She disguises herself as a prostitute on the way of where Judah's going. Judah doesn't recognize her. They end up sleeping together. She ends up being conceived by her father-in-law. And then when it comes out later, Judah doesn't realize who he slept with. When he comes out, hey, Judah, your sister or your daughter-in-law, Tamar, she's pregnant. He's like, we should kill her. That's awful. And then she presents to him his things that he gave to her as a pledge that he would pay, and he realizes that he is the one that fathered the child, and he's the problem. He's the one that makes the big mistake. Tamar ends up giving birth to twins, Perez and Zerah, and it is through that line that Jesus came. Wild story. So that's Tamar. We're off to a glowing start, aren't we? Okay, Rahab. Let's start with Rahab then. What is the story of Rahab? Well, Israel has come out of Egypt, and they have wandered around the desert for a while, and now they're going to enter into the promised land. They're going to go into Israel, and the first target that they have where God says, you're going to go in and kick out the people that are there, going to destroy them, is Jericho. Guess who lives in Jericho? Rahab. She is a Canaanite living there. So Joshua decides, he's the commander of the Israelite army, well, let's send two spies in, check it out, see what we should do. And then we'll go from there. So the two spies enter into the town. They end up at Rahab's house. I wonder why. It's possible it's clean. It's possible that they were doing what was right. I think it's more likely that they were going to the prostitute's house. So you can imagine what they were doing. They're not good spies because they're seen. They get noticed. So the king says, hey, go send to Rahab's house where we know that these spies of Israel are and bring them out. So you're doing great, spies. Good job. Awesome. So they go to Rahab's house. But you know what Rahab did? Rahab hid the spies. And she tells the guards that came, yeah, they were here and they went out that way. So they're running that way to go get Israel. You better go catch them, go find them. So the guards go run off and they chase after him. And then she goes and gets them off of the roof and says, okay, I'm going to let you out. Here's why. Because I know, I've seen what God is doing to all these other nations. I know he's going to come destroy us. I want to be on God's good side. And so will you promise to protect me and my family? And they say, yes. We will do that if you let us out. So the plan is she's going to let them out of the window of her house, which is right on the wall. They're going to escape, hang out for a few days while the guards are still trying to find them, and then make it back. And he says, if you take a scarlet thread, put it in your window, when we come to attack the city, you and every one of your family that's in your house, we're going to protect. We're going to keep safe. What does that remind you of? Passover. Remember Passover? Got to put the blood on the door. Otherwise, the angel of death is going to destroy you. But if you have that, then you're safe. So same kind of a concept there for the spies. The spies get out. They get back to Joshua. They let everybody know. They're terrified in there. Everyone is terrified because of what God is doing. And so the people are, their morale is high. And we know the rest of the story of the Battle of Jericho. So that is the story of Rahab. One final note on that. Then she apparently marries into the family of Israel. She marries an Israelite, becomes a part of the family, and it's, in fact, ends up being in the line that Jesus comes from. So, then the next person is Ruth. Ruth, we find in the book of Ruth. So, it starts out with a lady named Naomi. She has a couple of sons. There's a famine in Israel, and so they want to go to the land of Moab because there's food there. So they go, and while they're there, they meet a couple ladies. One of them is Ruth, and the boys marry these girls. Then the boys both die. So here's Naomi. Now she doesn't have any sons. She's got two daughters-in-law. She has no provision on her own. She's in trouble. She says, ladies, I'm going back to Israel. This is bad news. And you should stay here and find, go back to your family, figure out another way to live because God has abandoned me. I don't know what I'm going to do. The one daughter says, okay, I'll leave. And she leaves. But Ruth says, no, I'm going to stay with you. Where you lodge, I'm going to lodge. Who you serve, your people are going to be my people. Your God will become my God. And I'm going to serve you. So Ruth goes with Naomi and they go back to the land of Israel. And then when they're there, they end up back in Bethlehem. That's a town we know. They end up in Bethlehem. That's where they were from. And while they're there, she is going and taking food that is left in the fields. And while she's doing that, she makes contact with a guy named Boaz. Now it turns out, Naomi tells her, hey, Boaz, he's actually a family member. So, like, do a good job, stay nice with him. So she does. And eventually, Naomi concocts this plan. He could be your husband. By law, the way this works, if one of the family members dies, then family will come and marry the widow and take care of you. And so let's do this. When he's sleeping this night after they're having their party, I want you to go and proposition yourselves. And so the text says she goes at night, she goes to Boaz, she uncovers his feet, and we'll talk about that in a second. And he wakes up and he says, hey, what's going on? Who are you? She says, I'm Ruth. She essentially proposes marriage to him. And he says, hey, that's a great idea, but there's someone in line before me. There's another guy. There's another family member that's closer tied that they have to go through. So Boaz comes up with a plan. He says, all right, we're going to go to this kinsman redeemer. We're going to redeem. That's the idea, kinsman redeemer. That's the legal term that they use. So they go to him and they say, hey, I'll let you buy this field because it's in this family and you can have it. And he goes, great. And they go, oh yeah, Ruth comes with the package. So you'd marry Ruth. And he goes, no, I don't want to do that. So he rejects Ruth and allows Boaz to marry Ruth. He does. They end up having, I believe it's Obed. Let me make sure I got that in my notes. I don't have Obed in there, but Ruth is the grandmother of Jesse, and therefore, unless the genealogy is skipping some generations, she is the great-grandmother of King David. Awesome. That's where we get Bethlehem in the story. Okay, sorry, these are big stories. There's a lot here. We're done with three. Let's go to the fourth one. Bathsheba. Many of you probably know the story of Bathsheba. We'll go over it here. David is the king. And he has reached a tremendous level of victory over all his enemies, and he's got prosperity and all these things. So he's prosperous. Things are going well. And when all the kings are out going to war, what does he do? He stays at home, and he's chilling. He's hanging out. He's doing whatever he wants. So one night, he's up on his palace roof, and he sees a lady bathing. Now, it's hard to know whether she's like bathing what we would call full out naked or if it's like washing her hands and her feet, things like that. Either way, he's like, that girl, I want that girl. So he sends his people to go find out who is this girl. Turns out it's Bathsheba. She is married to Uriah the Hittite. This girl's married. And David goes, so what? I'm the king. So they go and they fetch her. She comes. They sleep together. She then comes back and says, David, I'm pregnant. This is a problem. That's a big problem. I'm about to get exposed. So he tries to get Uriah to come home from the battlefield. Hey, Uriah, come home and, hey, take it easy, man. Go home and sleep with your wife because I want you to think that you're the one that impregnated her, even though it was me. Uriah says no. So then he's like, oh, now I got to figure out what to do. I know what I'll do. He's out on the battlefield, and I'll tell the commander to retreat the troops and so that he's going to get killed in the battle. So this happens. David, through a plot, murders Uriah. Then he takes Bathsheba as his wife. She gives birth to the child. The son then gets sick as a punishment from God. It says in the text that God judges them, and the son ends up dying. Bathsheba, then it says David comes and comforts her. They sleep together again. They are now husband and wife. She then gives birth to Solomon, who becomes the king, and The line continues. Here are our stories. How about that for saying, yay, Jesus. Look at how great he is. He's coming from these people. These are not textbook cases for, yes, these are your prim and proper people that Jesus is coming from. So, returning to our question, what on earth is Matthew's purpose, including them? We're going to find the answer in the convergence of similarities that you see between their different stories of these four women. There's going to be several very strong correlations, but if we stay on the surface, it's actually hard to find one similarity. If we're looking at all four women, it's hard to find one similarity that encompasses all four ladies. Okay, one, they're all ladies, so that's one, but that doesn't take us too far. Let's look at some of the other ones. Some of them are connected to major characters, Tamar and Judah, Bathsheba and David, but the two spies with Rahab, so that one doesn't really fit too well. There seems to be a Gentile connection. Tamar's a Canaanite. Rahab's a Canaanite. Ruth is a Moabite, so they're all Gentiles. But what about Bathsheba? It's hard to tell. She's married to a Hittite. That's a Gentile. But is she a Gentile? So maybe that's some part of it. We have a few of them where they're seeking marriage or offspring, right? So Tamar is trying to get impregnated by Judah. Ruth is seeking Boaz. But then Rahab, we don't see that in the story. She's not seeking her major things that are happening, the major events. She's not seeking that. And Bathsheba, she saw it, not the other way around. So that one doesn't quite fit. We get some shady sexual situations, don't we? Some scandals here. Tamar, yeah, that's shady. Rahab, she's a prostitute, shady. Bathsheba. We've got David being very sinful in that one, shady. What about Ruth? Does that one fit? So I'll give you a little bit about Ruth. I'll give you some of the debate that's happening between scholars. I mentioned that in it, she uncovers his feet, and that's how he wakes up. There are some scholars that would think, even conservative scholars, that think that sometimes feet in the Hebrew language is a euphemism for genitalia. And so that turns things around a little bit. If she's uncovering his genitalia, then it looks a little different. Now, even if that's the case, there are possible cultural dynamics going into play where that's not necessarily a wrong or immoral thing. It doesn't mean that there's necessarily sexual interaction that's happening. There's still possible ways that Ruth has done well. I tend to think it's probably different than that. I think it's probably okay. It's probably just literal feet that she uncovers. It's cold outside. He wakes up because now he's not covered. I think that's more like the way it goes. So shady situations, yes, for three of them. I don't know about that fourth one. What about faith? Yes, we see that with Rahab. She hides the spies. Ruth is commended by Boaz, so she has faith. Is Tamar faithful by doing what she does with Judah? That's questionable. What about Bathsheba? She's kind of a passive one in that. So it's hard to find. If you look at it, there's several of these things where we have multiple convergences, but it's hard to get to that one. What is that one thing that he's getting at? What is the one thing he wants to drive at? So that's kind of looking at its surface level. Now let's look at it a little deeper. If you look at it deeper, the whole thing, we're going to get to the answer. So if we look at it, for each of these ladies, there's a moment, a crucial moment in their story where if you look at it and you look at where they are, you look at the situation that they're in, you're going to look at that and any normal person is going to look at that and they're going to say, this is a character, this is a poster child example of somebody that is not in God's will, that is not getting blessed by God, that is not on God's side. They are in the depths of despair, the darkness. They are not in a good situation for each of the women, right? We can think through each of them has that moment where it's going bad. Tamar, she's desolate and alone. She's been widowed twice, rejected by her father-in-law, and she's a Canaanite to make it even worse. Does that look like somebody that God uses? On the surface, no, it doesn't look that way. Rahab, she's a prostitute and likely unmarried and even despised among her own Canaanite people. She's residing in the first city that's going to be blown to bits by the Israelites. That doesn't look very good, very promising, very much like God is in favor of her. Ruth, she's a Moabite. They're not looked on very, very promising. And then she marries, but then her husband dies. Does that look like God's favor? Does that look like somebody that God typically uses? No. We have Bathsheba, whether she was willingly went along with the whole David incident or whether she was just forced to by the king. She gets impregnated by him. Then David kills her husband, marries her. Then she's holding her dead son, whom was fathered by her husband's killer. Think about that. Think about that situation that Bathsheba is in. Is that someone that you would say, looking at it, that's somebody that God is using right now? No. That looks like somebody that God has abandoned. Each woman have that situation that they're in. Tamar, incestual prostitute. Rahab, Canaanite prostitute. Ruth, Moabite widow. Bathsheba, holding her lifeless child with the son of her husband's murderer. Matthew is going to say to the question, are these the type of women that God would use? Matthew says unequivocally, unquestionably, yes, these are the type of women that God uses. These are the type of women that are right within God's will and are usable by him. That's what he's saying. Although the original stories leave some ambiguity, Matthew declares the fact of each of these ladies' faithfulness. He's pointing to the faithfulness that each of these ladies have. Even though we can look at that, the original story, and there's some details that aren't given there, Matthew is declaring, yeah, each of these ladies was actually faithful in what they went through. They may come from cursed backgrounds. They may seek their goal using deception like Tamar does, but they each had a core faithful seeking of God's will at the heart of it. It's hard for modern readers when we look at Tamar's situation, but if you look at it and you understand the culture, she goes about it in a really deceptive way. She goes about it in a really sneaky, wrong way. You don't want to do that. But what she's wanting is justice from Judah that is owed to her. She is owed the opportunity to try to have children through Judah's family. She's owed that. So she's seeking something that is good. Again, don't do it that way. That's not the right way to go about it. But at the core, what she's going for is righteous and just. Rahab, despite her past, when the moment comes, she chose God's side. She does what she was supposed to do. Ruth, even if her proposal was indecent, let's say that wasn't the right way to go or the cleanest way to go about it. She's doing it. It's coming from a place of trying to provide for Naomi, her mother-in-law, who's been made desolate. If I get married, I can have Boaz help me and take care of me and take care of Naomi as well. That's where it's coming from. That's righteous. And for Bathsheba, hey, chances are really strong that she was an unwilling participant in David's lust and scheming and plots. So in spite of being in a really, really dark situation, being forced by somebody who's God's representative, who's supposed to act like God and is doing the exact opposite, Matthew is saying, no, she's actually faithful in spite of that. Not only could God use these women, which is a statement in itself, God did. God did use these women. He used their line to save humanity. Through Tamar, Rahab, and Ruth, God brought the true King David, as messed up as he was at times, instead of Saul. David comes through those three ladies. And then through Bathsheba comes Solomon on down. Through all four of these ladies comes Jesus, the Savior of the world. I mentioned something about Bathsheba there. She was faithful even when God's servant was not representing God properly. And that's saying it mildly, right? That's saying it real mild. He wasn't representing God. Yeah, no kidding. This is another similarity that we're going to find within their stories and what Matthew is doing. So not only is there a time where these ladies look like they're on the out, but if we look at the men in these stories and we compare what the men are doing with these ladies, we're seeing something else that happens as well. These women are a foil to the different men. Tamar is a foil to Judah. Rahab is a foil to the spies. Ruth is a foil to the kinsman redeemer that rejects her. And Bathsheba is a foil to David. They're compared. And so what we see is that what is supposed to be the ones, the poster child of the ones that are supposed to be doing right, they end up doing wrong. And the ones that you would look at and go, no, those are the wicked ones, they end up the faithful ones. Everything's backwards in these four stories. So, Judah is Abraham's great-grandson. That's a pretty good lineage that you've got there of faith. But does he take care of Tamar? No, he fails to give his son, fearing God's going to take him as well. Although Tamar's actions, like we talked about, deceptive, at least she is going after something that is just, what she is owed from him. Judah, on the other hand, has taken that away from her. And we see Judah's, like we talked about last week, Judah's character switches after this incident. He sees how he should have been giving to Tamar a lot earlier than he did. Judah comes out the one that is wicked in the story. Now, thankfully, he turns it around. He redeems himself. Now, we go to Rahab. She's connected to the spies. And like I said before, what exactly are they doing in Rahab's house? And if you're a spy, rule number one is use stealth, right? They're found, they're discovered, the king is sending to Rahab, and then guess what happens? Rahab does what the spies were supposed to do. She conceals the spies who were supposed to be concealing themselves. So the ones that are supposed to be doing the work end up messing things up. And it is Rahab who ends up saving them and sending back good morale and a good message to the people. Then we have Ruth. Boaz is honorable. He's great. But there's another Israelite in line that should be taking his responsibility serious and taking care of Ruth. When that opportunity is presented to him, what does he do? He rejects Ruth. The book of Ruth leaves that guy nameless. You don't even get to know his name. He's not even worth putting his name in there. That's what the author is telling you. To not take your responsibility there and say, no, I don't want to do it. Boaz, you take her. That filthy Moabite woman. You don't get to even have your name be in the book. That's what Ruth does to that. So we have Ruth taking care of Naomi. We have this kinsman redeemer who could do that. And he says, no, I'm going to skirt my responsibility. Then we get to David, right? He's a man after God's own heart. That's what the Bible says. And yet, here we are. He is in the greatest seat of representation of who God is. The King of Israel. That is the place where you represent who God is. And what does he do? Hey, there's a woman. I want her. Great. Oh, I got into her trouble. What am I going to do? Let's try to scheme a plan where Uriah does it. Oh, that didn't work. I need to kill him now. So let's plot again. Horrible. When we look at the origins of these women and the men that they are compared to, and the story produces the opposite ending that we would expect, that's telling us something. It's telling us something very important. Here it is. A person's origins and previous actions do not tell the complete story of someone's acceptability before God. Sometimes those that look the most righteous are the most wicked, and other times the ones who look the most wicked are the most righteous. Why is this highlighted by Matthew? So if he thinks that's a big deal, and he wants to put that right in the beginning of the book, he wants to tell you out of the gate, this is what I want you to know. I want you to know that you can look at the outward appearance, but sometimes that's not telling you the whole story. Why does he want to do that? He's defending three things, okay? He's making three defenses. Number one, he's defending Mary. Why does he need to defend Mary? Think about what she's in. The Holy Spirit comes and she conceives of a child and she's not married. What does that look like for everybody around Mary? That doesn't look good. That looks scandalous, right? That looks really bad. So Matthew's saying, no, she is virtuous. What God did was virtuous. That moment of pregnancy looks bad from the outside, doesn't it? Well, let's think about it. That moment is actually where God is working most. That scandalous looking action is where God is working most. The greatest act of love, of God becoming human to save us all, initially looks scandalous to everybody around Mary, including her betrothed Joseph. That's the way it looks to everybody. And that's the moment where God is working most. Matthew is signaling that just as these ladies' situations, they looked shady, man. They looked bad. God was actually working through them, and he had done the very same thing with Mary. And so then there's also a second defense. Then that's a defense of Jesus. Why? Because Jesus is tied into the scandal of his mother. So if her situation looks shady, how do people view Jesus then? So he makes those two defenses, but I said there were three. What's the third defense? The third defense that he's making is himself. Matthew. Remember Matthew? Remember us talking about Matthew? He's a tax collector. That's who he is. Who are the tax collectors again? These were the people that took money from good, hardworking Jews, and they sent it to the evil, wicked empire, the Romans. This is like taking money from Luke and Han Solo and sending it to Darth Vader. That's who you are if you're a tax collector. That's how they view you. You are wicked. You are a traitor. You have abandoned God's people. That's who you are, Matthew. When they talked about it, it was like the tax collectors and sinners. You can sin a lot of different ways, but they specified tax collector. Okay? You're a nasty, bad dude. That's the way they viewed him. So how could a tax collector be used by God? And furthermore, there's all these disciples running around that are following Jesus. Guess what a lot of them are? They're those tax collectors and those sinners. So Matthew's defending himself. He's defending all of these people. And he's saying, look, you don't think that because of where they came from, God can use them? You're wrong. Absolutely wrong. And what we're going to see is there's these battles that happen between the very clean Pharisees. They look pretty. They look nice. They look like they have it all together. And they're constantly going and fighting back and forth between the tax collectors and the disciples. And get this, God's son, Jesus. So Matthew's saying, be on the right side here. Recall those situations that we talked about in the beginning where there's only one thing that matters, right? There's only one thing that matters. Hey, if you're an employee and everybody thinks, all the customers think you're nice, that's awesome. But if you don't make sales, it doesn't matter, right? You could be a great soccer team and you could be absolutely wiping the field with the other team. But if you don't score a goal, if you clank it off the goalpost 12 times, but one time the other team gets lucky and sneaks it into your goal, you lost. There's one thing that matters, the goals. Frustration and sometimes even fury ensues when your hope and your investment fails because you lack that one essential quality. The same is true with religion. It can appear to us that we know who is in and who is out. That's the way the Pharisees were. And when Jesus came and said, no, you got it wrong, fury ensued to the point that they put him on the cross. Sometimes a tainted outward past can veil the hidden inner saint. And sometimes a privileged pedigree can veil the hidden inner demon. So, what is the one thing that matters to God? There's a whole lot of things that we can think matter to him. What's the one thing that matters to him? Love. That's what it is. That's all you need. All you need is love. That's it. That's all he wants. That's the one thing you need. Love. I'm not singing again. That went way better than I thought it would. So I had a moment where I thought, are you going to do this? Are you going to do this? You're not a good singer. It worked out. It went okay. So what does that look like? What does that look like to love God? What are we talking about there? Well, first off, that's not the right question. The right question is, what is love in reality? So let's talk about that. What is it to love God in reality? What is needed to love is faith. That's what loving God is. Faith in proper relation that acts. That's the components of it. You have to believe in him and have proper relation with him, and that faith needs to produce actions. So what is believed in? The person of God revealed to them. So who God reveals himself to you, you need to believe that. You need to believe him and put your faith in that. Now, how does a believer act in accordance to the commands of God? What's the proper relationship? Dependence upon him. That's what loving God looks like. So, what does that sound like to you? That sounds like the same situation that was in Deuteronomy. Remember, we went through Deuteronomy. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. That's the same thing. And that love should lead to action. But we don't get to see faith, do we? Right? Like, you don't get to look in my life and see, in my heart deep down, do I really have faith? I can't look at you and say that. So all I can look at is the external. That's all I get, right? That's all you get. That's all we can see. The trouble is that it's possible for my external to look just like someone else's external. And one of us could be a believer and one of us couldn't be. It's possible for believers and non-believers to look the same on the outside. The way you tell the two apart is not the surface action, it's the heart. It's the depth underneath. Is this action hollow, or is it dense and filled with a supernatural energy that only comes from God's Spirit? That's what you're looking at. So if you look at someone's actions and you look at two different people and they both could be doing the exact same action, but if one has a depth, a spirit to it, that you can sense that the Spirit of God is working there, that's the one that actually has the relationship with the Lord. If the other one looks hollow, that doesn't. We're not just looking for external action, folks, but inner transformation. We want God to transform us. It's not enough to serve at the church. Man, people serve at all sorts of organizations. It's not enough for you to just give to the church. Muslims give all sorts of monies to make amazing mosques. Okay, it's not just about the action. It's about the heart that causes the action. That's what really matters. We're going to see over and over again in Matthew's gospel, as we go through this book, people who look like they are God's people, but they are wolves in sheep's clothing. You're going to see this over and over again. And then there's others that appear that they look like they hang out with the devil. That's what it looks like. But when the moment comes in the story, guess what happens? They ally with the Christ. They ally with God's side. In the end, these saints, they love God. On the other hand, for all the Pharisees, religion and virtue signaling, pomp, show, devotion, and deprivation and denial of these outward visible sins, they were rank with a hollow death inside their soul. Void of the one thing that mattered. They had a bunch of other things, but they didn't have that one thing. So what do we learn from all this? What do you take away from all of this? I've got two things I want you to focus on and one aim I want you to strive for. So, two things I want you to focus on. Number one, don't judge a book by its cover. Don't look at the external to see, is someone on the inside? Are they with God or are they not? That's not the right metric. The right metric is the heart, okay? You look at the heart. That's what God cares about. So, one thing that comes from that, be encouraged. Be encouraged. You're not too far gone. Even if all these other people in here are looking at you like stink eye, like, man, that person, they got all sorts of problems, right? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Because that's not what God is looking at. He's not looking at the way you look on the outside. He's not looking at the where you came from, what side of the tracks you came from. He's not looking at that. So be encouraged. You got a shot. You can still get that one thing. Guess what else? That person that you love, right? We got some clean looking people in here that look really Christian, but you guys have family members, you guys have loved ones, and they don't look right, right? They don't look right. They look on the outside. Guess what? They're not too far gone. Those people are not too far gone for God to save them, for them to get the one thing that they need to love God. They are not too far gone. So be encouraged. All right? Evaluate the heart, not the externals. That's what you do. If you're going to make an evaluation, trying to make an understanding, do it on the heart, not the externals. And then, what are you supposed to foster? Foster your heart. Don't spend all your time fostering on how it looks to other people. Please, please don't be that person that spends your time and your energy and your care and your worry and your anxiety about how am I going to come across. It doesn't matter. That doesn't matter at all. Foster your heart. Go deep down into your heart. Make that what you care about. Hey, look, there's a lot of good things that we give as a church. There's a lot of reasons that anyone could come to a church. There's a lot of good stuff you get. Next week, you get some awesome food, right? For free. That's great. Like, even if you don't bring food, we're still going to let you eat. So there's benefits to joining a church, right? There are friendships that you can make. You can come and do all this fun stuff. Look, don't make the externals what you come for. We're not going to apologize for giving those benefits, right? But make sure you're not coming for those reasons. Make sure you're coming because you are meeting God here. That's what we're doing, all right? Hey, great, enjoy the fellowship. I'm going to enjoy the food next week. But that's not why I'm coming here. That's not it. I'm coming here because I'm experiencing the Lord through all of you. And I'm serving the Lord by serving you and fellowshipping with you. Last one. On this point, don't you dare judge someone that comes in here looking wrong. Don't you dare do that. That is not who we are. That is not who Christ is. So let's not make judgments about how people look or appear or they look like they could be trouble. Perfect. They're the exact people we want in here. We talked about that, right? It's not the healthy that need a physician. It's the sick. We want the sick, even if they look sick. It's a great indicator. They're the right ones. Huh. Now, that's not to say we're going to throw out all wisdom and caution and like, hey, well, let's just let anything happen in here. Pastor says we're just going to let it. We're not saying that. We're saying judgment, right? We're saying about how you evaluate people. That's what we're talking about. All right, that's the first one. Don't judge a book by its cover. Number two. I want you to focus on this. This is what God does. God adopts the outsider. This is who he is. This is what he does. He goes and he takes those that are on the outside of the camp, those that are far off, the foreigner, the Gentile, the lost, the sinner, and he grabs those people and he brings them into his family. That's who he is. And if we get caught thinking that just because we've gone to church for 25, 45 years, that somehow now we're on the inside and somehow now we don't have to look back at our origin and we can forget that in the beginning we were his enemies too and we needed his grace. We're off, man. All of us are on the outside when it starts. The only reason we're on the inside is because of what Jesus did for us. So let's not act like, oh, we have some special privilege, like we were born into Silver Spoon and we went to Harvard and all of that, right? The church acts like that sometimes. Oh, I've been at church forever and I've had this, my parents were that, and blah, blah, blah. Who cares? You needed Jesus' salvation to make you clean. And guess what? He was happy to do it. This is his game. Take the lost, save them. So, focus on not judging a book by its cover, and remember that the core of who God is this. He goes and gets the outsider. So finally, here's a call for you. Here's what I want you to aim for. I want you to have a name. What does that mean? What is he talking about? Have a name. What is he talking about? Hey, the two spies in the story of Rahab, what was their name? You don't know. The two spies, what they did. You don't get their name. Their name's not recorded. Why? Because they weren't worth recording their names in. Story of Ruth, what's the kinsman redeemer name? The one that left, he doesn't get a name. He's left nameless. Whose name gets put in the front of Jesus' genealogy? Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, Bathsheba. When the story ends, those that had the one thing that mattered, they got a name. The ones that were righteous, those ladies that were righteous, they got a name. Even Judah and David, even though they messed up, they redeemed themselves. And we look back on them and we look back on their names and we hold them in high regard. Why? Because they had the one thing that mattered. They loved the Lord. They had seasons where they were absolutely wicked, but they turned it around. They redeemed themselves. And we know their name. This parallels with what we find in Revelation. Revelation chapter 2, verse 17. So when it's all over, when it's all said and done, when you have lived your life, you are dead, you come before the Lord, this is what he says. To him who overcomes, to him I will give some of the hidden manna and I will give him a white stone and a new name written on the stone which no one knows but he who receives it. You will receive a new name by God. Amazing. It doesn't matter where you start. You can still have a name in the end. Your pedigree doesn't get you there. Your history doesn't get you there. That one thing you need is to love the Lord your God. And if you do that, the biography of this world, when everything's all done, when he describes the great history of this creation, when he describes things that matter, he's going to record your name in the book. And when heaven opens up and the book of life is open, guess whose name is going to be there? It's going to be yours. So go, make sure you have a name and you're recorded in those books. Let me pray. Heavenly Father, forgive us for failing if we have ever been judgmental against one of your children. Forgive us if we have forgotten that we needed saving. Forgive us if we think that we deserve some high and mighty place just because of our pedigree or something in the past that doesn't matter, Lord. Forgive us if we put something in the place of the one thing that matters that doesn't belong to be there. God, the reason we have a name is because you created us and you loved us. I pray, Lord, for all my brothers and sisters here. I pray that you would give us that name. I pray that we would love you, Lord, and we would give you this life. I pray that we wouldn't look at the external, but we would look deep down into the heart at the deep core of the matter. That we would see people the way that you see them. And Lord, may you transform us to be like you. Because you are glorious. And your glory deserves to shine in our midst. And the lost need to see it. We pray this in your name, amen.